This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, good to see you.
We survived another Minnesota winter.
Still digging it. Well, I'm not sure it's over yet.
No, I don't think it is.
I'm happy to tell you is that today we've got a whole show devoted to the weaker sex. I said that.
No, I can't.
Yeah. Well, we need to talk about men. Men finally have the spotlight. And boy, do they need it. You know, men, I think, have just about as many medical problems as women, although I'm not sure about that. But they just don't go to the doctor unless their wives absolutely insist on it. We don't like the doctor. You know, we should. We should go and we should listen to our wives, no question about it. But today, finally, the focus is where it should be, on the men. We need to save the men of the world. Have you ever been to the nursing home and, you know, there's a whole bunch of women there and not many men?
Makes you think, doesn't it?
Well, it does, and these poor women need some male companionship. That women, I think, on average, live 81 years in the United States, and men only 76, so there's a five-year gap in there. So we really need to talk about men's health today.
We've got it covered. Yes, today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we're going to talk with four men's health specialists.
Oh, perfect.
Starting off with hormone expert Dr. Todd Nippolt about testosterone, low testosterone. That's the big deal.
And here's what will blow you away. I just saw this week, and it's a quote from Dr. William Young, who is a colleague of Dr. Nippold in the Department of Endocrinology. And here's what he says. So successful has the marketing for testosterone therapy been that, according to drugs.com, an independent medicine website, sales of the testosterone gel Androgel in 2013 exceeded sales of Viagra.
Wow.
Can you believe it?
Wow. All right. So we're going to talk about that to get it started. Then we're also going to talk about gout, which is, well, a man's disease, but women can get it too.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yep.
We'll talk symptoms and diagnosis and treatment with rheumatologist Dr. Tom Osborne. After the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk heart health with our guy, Dr. Stephen Kopetsky, about four things you need to know to keep your heart healthy. And prostate expert Dr. Matthew Tollefson is going to answer the question whether you should or should not have a PSA blood test. And if you do have prostate cancer, is treatment worse than the disease?
All right. So a lot of good things to talk about, and it's all devoted to men's health. And last week, we spent pretty much the whole time on women. So it's only fair.
It's only fair. You're right.
All right. Dr. Nippold is on the line. Dr. Nippold, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
So why all the recent interest in testosterone and testosterone replacement? What is the deal?
Well, I think that a lot of it relates to what you had mentioned about the direct to the patient advertising that the manufacturers of testosterone preparations have been doing lately. It's all over the television, raising the awareness of symptoms that are actually quite common, that it may be associated with abnormally low testosterone levels.
So there are people, I am sure, who have a low testosterone level for whom treatment might be indicated, but for the majority of people, not true, correct?
Well, yes. The diseases that cause low testosterone are relatively uncommon, but it's very common as one gets older that the testosterone levels decline as one ages. It can drop about on average about 1% per year, but there's such a wide range of what's considered normal as well, then, that there are lots of older men whose testosterone levels are even higher than normal men without any symptoms who are younger have. The normal range is a threefold difference. So you could have three times as much as the next guy, and both of you are still in a normal range.
Would it be fair to say that this has been a situation for years and years and years, but all of a sudden people are thinking, well, I should get my testosterone levels checked, and then they're finding out that they have low testosterone? Or is that fair to say?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. You know, the symptoms are very, very what we call nonspecific. They're common, and they can be due to lots of different conditions in addition to low testosterone. So the point of all of that is, if you have symptoms that are listed as those of low testosterone and may or may not be the reason, and not having an absolutely known test to tell you what your testosterone level had been and then what it is now, it's hard to make that correlation.
So what are some of those symptoms?
Well, fatigue is a very common symptom that can be seen with low testosterone. Some people have changes in their beard and body hair growth, some people have some muscle wasting, decrease in muscle strength. Low sexual interest is a common symptom of testosterone deficiency. But actual erectile dysfunction can certainly occur with testosterone deficiency. But when you look at all the causes of erectile dysfunction, the hormonal causes are actually in a minority of the cases.
Sure. Most of it's due to hardening of the arteries and atherosclerosis, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so who should think about having their testosterone level checked? And when you go in for your physical exam, they've never suggested that I have that checked. Who do people come in requesting that it be checked?
Yes, now that's quite common. That we see patients that come in and usually by the time I see them, they've had it checked by their primary care doctor, and they say, you know, they were watching TV and said, you know, I feel just like all these symptoms that are on the ads. And I said, could you get my testosterone level checked? I think it's reasonable to test for it, because you don't want to just attribute these symptoms to aging. You know, that's the other side of the coin that we see. People ignore the symptoms and think, oh, it's just that I'm getting old, that these are happening. So I think it's reasonable to discuss with your primary care doctor if testosterone could be playing a role there. But it's the interpretation of the testing afterwards that you really want to make sure is done appropriately, and not just jump to replacement.
The gel. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So are these patients saying, oh, I would just like the gel, instead of maybe treating some of these other things that are going on that are leading to these conditions?
Yes, that's right. As you mentioned, there are other treatable medical conditions that, as part of that, they cause the testosterone to be low. And if you would treat the underlying cause, the low testosterone will correct itself. And so that's why it's important to just not rely totally just on a lab test. If you're found to have some testosterone that's felt to be on the low side with appropriate symptoms, you need to ask your doctor about what the cause of that is. And then there's just a few extra tests that need to be done, and that can confirm, you know, as the cause that in your particular situation, why the testosterone is low, and guide on if there needs to be further treatment of an underlying disease or not.
And you would never take a testosterone supplement without having your testosterone checked and without talking with your doctor first, correct?
Correct, yeah. That's the... You know, if it doesn't really matter, you know, if you increase your testosterone within the normal range, it's not going to make any changes. Now, taking supra physiologic doses, very high doses that you know, has been used by athletes and mm-hmm. bodybuilders and things in the past. That's a very dangerous thing to do.
And it's not side effect free, right? There are some potential side effects of testosterone supplementation in older men, right?
Oh, yes. And that's why, once again, it's important that you, if you do end up starting on testosterone replacement, that you have to work out a monitoring plan with your doctor to make sure that the dose that you've prescribed is correct for you, that it's adequate to treat your symptoms, but not too much to give you high levels. So if you're able to keep the testosterone level on treatment in the normal range, the side effects are relatively uncommon. But there's excess of treatment, the two main things that can cause is increase in red blood cell production. We call that polycythemia, and that can lead to other issues with blood clotting and stroke. And then there's potential effects on the prostate, both potentially aggravating prostate obstructive symptoms. And although we don't think that taking a testosterone supplement causes prostate cancer, prostate cancer is very common, as I'm sure you're going to be discussing later, and it does grow under the influence of testosterone, so that has to be monitored for as well.
And finally, before we go, we can't do a show on men's health without talking about this. So myth or matter of fact, do higher testosterone levels cause baldness? Is that a myth or is that a fact?
Well, I think it's a myth. The tendency to baldness is more of a genetic tendency, and if you line up people and at one end there's bald people, another end there's unbald people, their testosterone levels are not going to be any significantly different. It's the personal response to the scalp skin that individual has inherited that determines the baldness.
It's your genes.
Got
Dr.
it.
Todd Nipple, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
You bet. We'll take a short break. Coming up, we'll continue our conversation on men's health. We'll talk about prostate cancer with Dr. Matthew Tollefson, heart health with Dr. Stephen Kopetsky, and up next, gout with Dr. Thomas Osborne.
Yeah, we'll find out, myth or matter of fact, is gout curable? Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae. Next up, rheumatologist Dr. Thomas Osborne. Dr. Osborne, welcome. Good to have you on the program.
Glad to be here.
So you are the gout guy.
I am, one of them.
Yeah, and this is mainly a disease that affects men, correct?
Yeah, about 20 to 1, men to women.
And what is gout?
Well, it's too much uric acid, which is a waste product that we give off when we digest meats, and some of our own tissues have to turn over, and we get rid of this stuff in our urine. It's called uric acid.
And
it's a bad boy.
And if you don't get rid of it, you get gout, huh? If you don't
you get
rid of enough of it.
Correct. You get too much uric acid, and it depends on the level, but if it goes up, you're probably going to get gout.
So why does it affect men more than women?
Well, men run a higher level than women until women go through menopause, then the women catch up. So about 20 years difference there. So the men get the gout earlier, so more men get gout.
Yeah, you're not completely in the clear. I want you to know that.
Yeah.
All right. I won't make fun. Are there other inflammatory type diseases that men have? Is like lupus, or are there things in that range?
Well, most of the stuff we see in rheumatology, my field, autoimmune diseases, affect women more than men. So gout's kind of unique in that regard. There's a few things, you know, in the old days, men worked more in labor than the women did. So we tended to think the men's knees wore out more and the women's hands wore out more. But that's not true anymore.
Okay, so this starts in the big toe or affects the big toe. And why is that? And tell us what the symptoms are.
Yeah, that's a real puzzle, but it's true. Called podagra, and it's that ball joint in your big foot, and it's like the devil sticking a pitchfork in there. And that's often the first time the person gets it, that's where it hits. Later on, it could hit any joint in your body, but it has a preference for that. We think it's just a long way from the heart. That's the best explanation I have.
Oh, no kidding. All right, well, that's okay.
Yeah,
we'll accept that.
It is kind of odd because it seems comical almost. The word gout is kind of funny to say, and a big having it affect your big toe is kind of a comical thing. But people that I know who have been stricken with gout say it's the most painful thing that they have ever felt in their life. So it must really make a big change for people when they're diagnosed.
Yeah, it's not subtle. When they get that podagra, it's considered one of the top pains in the world. It's up there with childbirth and kidney stones, and it hurts to even lay the sheets on. Some people will say it hurts to even have somebody's eyeballs look at that joint when it hurts.
Okay, so somebody comes in with a toe like that, and that's often the first symptom. Can you make the diagnosis by looking at the toe, or do you do some blood tests, or do you suck some fluid out of that joint, or how do you do it?
All of the above. But you can't be sure until you get fluid out and actually see if the gout crystals are crystals, like salt crystals, only they're urate crystals or uric acid. So we try to get a needle in there. Not your favorite place to stick a needle when it hurts so bad you can't touch it.
And once you do that, you've confirmed the diagnosis. And what's the treatment?
Well, there's several. First, we got to cool that joint off. So there's medicines that we have that'll lower the blood uric acid, the bad boy. It'll lower that stuff in there, in your bloodstream. But if you do that when a person's having a gout attack, you just make it worse. It would seem logical, but it absolutely backfires. So we got to cool it off, usually with something like an anti-inflammatory or a steroid dose pack or something called colchicine.
And once you get the acute attack under control, then I assume long-term you try to control the uric acid either with dietary changes or medication, correct?
Right, correct, yeah. Alcohol has been considered an offender, and it turns out that beer is worse than wine. Heck, some people don't think wine will do it at all if you just have one or two glasses. Spirits aren't as bad. Something about beer is worse. High-protein, high-meat diet, fish, seafood, those things are aggravators. But often we'll put the person on a pill after it's cooled off if they've had two or three attacks in a year. If they just had one attack, we just wait and treat it if they get anything.
So is it fair to say that you're managing it more than you're curing it?
I think that's fair to say.
Oh, see, then that goes right to our myth or matter of fact. Gout is curable.
It's fixable, and some people will outgrow it, you know. There's another part to this. This uric acid stuff that causes gout sometimes can be high in a person's bloodstream and doesn't cause the gout. And now, more recently, we find that we think it's related to heart disease.
Oh. Related to what?
Heart disease. So
really?
People with gout for a long time have been known to have more high blood pressure, more heart disease, generally overweight. You know, there's things that go with having the gout. But even in people without the gout with that high uric acid, we notice the heart disease is higher. So now they're beginning to treat people with this high uric acid, never had the gout, just because it's the risk factor for heart disease. But that's kind of new.
Now, it's also important to recognize that this has some more serious complications if it's not kept under control, right? I mean, it can destroy the joint.
That's right. It can gnaw holes in the bone and in the joint cartilage and make the joint not work, and then you got to put a new joint in if you can.
Wow, that sounds even worse. So this starts with the big toe, and then it can go to any other joint. Does it just kind of go down the toe joints, or does it go up into the knees, or what happens next?
Yeah, most people will start out in the toe or the foot or the ankle down there somewhere. Occasionally we'll see somebody with it in their elbow the first time, but then it starts to spread around, and it can be anywhere, but it tends to be the first several years or first several attacks a person has is down in the lower foot or toe. And then anything's fair game. Elbows, anything you want to talk about.
Well, we know that this is a disease that's more common in men. What are some other risk factors?
Well, who your parents are, and hereditary. You know, if there's gout in the family, Uncle Bob had it and Dad had it, you got the target on your back. But and then what you eat, you know, the high fish, high protein, a lot of seafood, a lot of booze, dehydration, sitting out in the sun, and then certain meds will set it off. Some of the water pills that people take can do it, and there's strange things, real bizarre things you don't see much, like lead poisoning, lead levels.
So, what about obesity?
Well, it's related statistically, but, you know, there are plenty of people who are a little overweight or severely overweight that never will get gout. So it's just in a statistical association there.
Once you have gout, and let's say that your uric acid level is up, so you're prone to attacks and you've had two or three of them, the medications that you have now to control the uric acid level, to prevent the attacks and prevent the serious consequences are pretty good, aren't they?
They're very good. We have to get those introduced slowly, so that's a little bit of a problem sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then even on them, occasionally a person will have a gout attack. You can override the meds if you do everything wrong, like drink beer, sit out in the sun, and eat a lot of fish. Sounds like a Canada fishing trip, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like if the pain is as bad as I've heard it described, I would think you might have some motivated patients, though, to try to control that.
They're usually motivated, particularly when they're having the attack.
No, I was just, something you said that sometimes you can grow out of gout, and women don't get it until after menopause often. So what is the age piece that has to do with this? Is there a certain age of gout patients?
I don't know for sure. If you begin to look at people, we'll see gout in any age after puberty in men, at any age, but it really peaks around 40. Some people have had the gout, they've had lots of attacks, they're on the med, they're doing well, and they'll drift off the med, and for 10 years, the last 10 years of their life, they won't have a gout attack. But that's not universally true. But I don't know what happens. They lose weight, or they eat different, or stop drinking booze, or who knows?
Drinking beer, yes.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
So the medications to treat the acute attack are different than the medications you use long term to control the uric acid in the blood.
Exactly.
And the most common, do you still use? Is it colchicine? Is that the name of the medication that you use up front for acute attacks?
Well, we use either colchicine or non-steroidal, usually indomethacin or prednisone.
And then long term common medications.
Allopurinol, and then a newer one out called febuxostat or Uloric. Those two get used now, predominantly allopurinol.
All right. So we've got about 20 seconds remaining. Tell us how a person with gout can keep from getting another attack, aside from medications. What do they need to avoid?
Stay away from beer. Don't eat a lot of fish. And thin down.
All right. There you go. Perfect. Good advice. Hey, Dr. Thomas Osborne, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
All right. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guests are all men's health experts. Coming up, we've got heart health with Dr. Stephen Kopetsky and prostate health with Dr. Matthew Tollefson.
Actually, we've also got medical news with Vivian Williams, and a moment in Mayo history is coming up, Tom.
Well, that's exciting.
You can follow us on Twitter at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Here's some info about using technology to improve patient care, in specific, smartphones. Two new smartphone apps may help people detect epileptic seizures and get better stroke treatment. This is from two studies that will be presented at the American Academy of Neurology's annual meeting. In one study, researchers from the UK looked at an app designed to help people who are not doctors tell if someone's having a seizure. In the other study, researchers from the University of Pennsylvania looked at a stroke app that makes it easier and more efficient for doctors to manage patients who have acute strokes. Now, these two apps are part of a growing number of smartphone applications designed to improve patient care. And now here's some news from Mayo Clinic. Newly diagnosed patients with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma who do not experience any cancer-related outcome events for 2 years after diagnosis have essentially the same life expectancy as they did before diagnosis. Here's researcher Matthew Maurer.
Diffuse large B-cell lymphoma is a cancer of the immune system, specifically your B lymphocytes or white blood cells. Patients who achieve this event-free status at 2 years have a prognosis that is similar to what it was prior to their diagnosis. And so what we found is that there was, even though there was a significant survival gap, we saw that gap diminish the longer the patients were in remission.
Results of the study are in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And now moving on to news about a connection between the thyroid gland and depression. Research shows an active thyroid may raise the risk of depression in older people. Now, the thyroid helps regulate your body's metabolism, and it can also influence mental health. Past research shows this link with both over- and underactive glands. Well, the new study is the first to show a connection with thyroid activity that's in the normal range. In particular, in the high end of the normal range. Well, the researchers say this info could help with diagnosing and treating depression, as well as treatments for thyroid issues, and it was published in the Journal of Endocrinology and Metabolism. And now here's some more about the thyroid. A study shows the rise in number of cases of thyroid cancer seems to be the result of what some are calling an epidemic of diagnosis and not disease. Now, since 1975, the incidence of thyroid cancer has nearly tripled, but the death rate
hasn't really changed much, mostly because of more diagnoses of a specific form of the disease called papillary thyroid cancer. And they say it's important for doctors to explain that many of these small cancers will never grow and cause harm, but it's not possible to know which cancers are in that category. Now, this study was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, and that's a look at health and medical news. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. This week's topic is men's health, and we're going to talk about the heart and the prostate. But first, a moment in Mayo history.
That's
Gracie,
right, Tom.
Take it away.
It was 150 years ago that Dr. William Worrell Mayo began his medical practice in Rochester. And since we know everything in Rochester that's happened since then. So each week we're going to share a moment in Mayo history with you, starting with the importance of education. The commitment to education originated with W.W. Mayo at a time when many physicians had no formal education. He earned two medical degrees. W.W. Mayo's passion for education began early. He was born in Manchester, England in 1819 and lost his father at the age of seven. In 1846, he moved to the U.S. He worked briefly in New York City before moving to Indiana and eventually Minnesota. He graduated from the Indiana Medical College in February of 1850 and the University of Missouri in February of 1854. Dr. Mayo inspired the next generation, his sons, William and Charles, to study medicine too. Will earned his medical degree from the University of Michigan. A family council was held to determine it would be best for Charlie to get a different viewpoint, so he went to Northwestern University. Dr. Will and Dr. Charlie also shared a lifelong love of learning. Education for healthcare professionals, patients, and the public is a key activity of Mayo Clinic. Along with patient care and research, education is represented in the three shields of the institution's logo. To learn more about Mayo Clinic history, go to 150years.mayoclinic.org, including a cool video about how they preserved the diplomas of W.W. Will and Charlie. That's kind of neat.
Do you think they'll preserve mine for any reason?
I think it's important.
I do have a diploma.
That's the most important part.
Tracy, very, very well done. Intensely interesting. All right, let's talk about the heart with our friend, not our old friend,
no.
Dr. Stephen Kopetsky. Welcome, Dr. Kopetsky. Good to have you, as always.
Thank you, Dr. Shives. And, you know, it was 100 years ago this year we did our first electrocardiogram at Mayo Clinic.
Yeah, and it was probably 100 years ago today you did your first show. Yeah.
No,
maybe not quite that long. Hey, it's always good to talk to you. So we know, especially from last week, that heart disease remains the number one killer of both men and women in the United States. Do you think most Americans, men and women, understand that?
No, they clearly don't, Tom. You know, less than 10% of Americans, when you ask them what disease do they worry about most, less than 10% say heart attack, though it's the number one killer, as you point out.
Isn't that interesting? Don't you find that just mind-boggling?
Well, part of that is I think we've done such a good job treating it and in putting a stent in and putting people on drugs, and they do very well. The other thing is two-thirds of the deaths are sudden death. Mm. And so we don't see the lingering death that you see with an Alzheimer's or a cancer-type patient.
That's an excellent point, because I've always wondered, why is it that people don't get more worked up about their heart? And that's probably one of the good reasons.
Sure. No, it's very true. And but we all have had friends or family that have had breast cancer or Alzheimer's, and it's painful for years and years.
So we have made some progress, though, wouldn't you say? I mean, you're better at treating heart disease and preventing heart disease than we've ever been?
That's very true, Tom. The rates of death of heart disease have gone down for the last few decades.
All right. So let's talk about, we know from talking to you in the past that prevention is really the key. So let's talk about the four big risk factors and the four things we all should do to have a healthy heart.
Well, they really are key, and we as individuals control all of them. You know, the most important is smoking and not smoking. And if you do smoke, quit, because even if someone in your family smokes, your risk of heart attack goes up just by smelling it on their hair or their clothes.
Wow.
The second thing is probably our weight. You know, that's a huge national problem now, with two-thirds of us overweight and a third of us obese. And that's getting to be a worse problem every year. The third is eating at least five fruits or vegetables a day and serving as a tennis ball. And only about one in five of us do that, although we have some wonderful fruits and vegetables available at the stores and such. And the last thing is activity. And this is where we've really fallen down, not just in America, but all over the world over the last decade or two. We're just not active, and we need to be active, physically active, for at least probably 150 minutes a week. But I tell patients, if you can't be active that amount of time, just do 10 minutes three times a week. That'll start to help lower your chance of dying or having a heart attack.
Yeah, we did the Women's Health Heart Show last week, and at the very end we said it's 5, 10, 8, which you just touched on, 5 fruits and vegetables, 10 minutes of exercise, if you can add that in, and 8 hours of sleep. That's my favorite part.
It's good. And you sleep better after you exercise.
Hey, so expand a little bit on the exercise. I like your story about even if you exercise in the morning and then you go sit in a chair for 8 or 9 hours at your desk all day, that the sitting part can be bad.
Yeah, you know, our bodies are really made to move around. We didn't used to get up in the cave a million years ago and turn to our spouse and say, honey, I'm going to go jog for half an hour and get you a latte. You'd say, honey, I'm going to try to go find some food and not be killed.
Try to stay alive.
Stay alive. That's right. Stay alive. You'd walk along, you'd see a rabbit or something and chase it for a couple of minutes, or something would see you and chase you for a couple of minutes, but it wouldn't be a half an hour. And so what our bodies are designed to do is get up and move frequently at regular paces and then have little short bursts of energy where we go faster.
You know, ideal weight, I know you talk about that, and you talk about controlling your weight. And one thing that you always refer to is BMI, and you want to keep your BMI around 25. And I think that's a little bit hard for people to understand. So I want our audience to know that all you have to do is go to the internet and put in BMI, and it's pretty easy to plug in your height and weight, and it'll tell you what your BMI is, right? And you want it around 25.
Yeah, it's perfect. If you can do that, you would be in the minority, believe me, but that's what your goal should be.
There is a way to figure it out mathematically, but it's a lot easier to go to the table.
I'd have to be an orthopedic surgeon to be able to figure it out.
Oh, yeah, it's that complicated.
I would say we have two doctors suggesting just go to the internet and figure it out over there.
All right, so number one, don't smoke. Number two, maintain an ideal weight with a BMI around 25. 5 fruits and vegetables per day. That's the toughest one, isn't it? How many people actually do that?
You
got some studies on that, don't you?
Oh, yeah. 1 in 5 people actually eat the fruits and vegetables, and which is kind of silly because we can go to our convenience stores right near our house, and for $1.29, we can get 3 pieces of fruit. Pretty cheap.
All right, yeah. And 150 minutes of vigorous exercise per week. Now, how many people do all 4 of those things?
Well, 3% of Americans, and mostly of Western world, do all 3 of those, which is sad because it means 97% of us aren't doing it. But it accounts for almost 90% of our heart attacks.
All right. So if you did those 4 things, how much could you reduce your risk of heart attack and heart disease by? How much?
Well, if you did those 4 in just 4 years, you'd reduce it by 40%, which is better than all the stents and the bypass and all the statins that we have. If you did it for a couple of decades, it would reduce it almost 90%.
Last week when we were talking about women's hearts, we learned that women, when they have a heart attack, present a lot differently. It's not just a clutch your chest kind of Hollywood heart attack. Women are a lot different. But men don't always have a heart attack that looks like a Hollywood one either, do they?
No, definitely not. A lot of times, especially when you're over age 65, and that's the reason most women have their first heart attack over age 65, they mainly get short of breath. In men that are older, that's the number one presenting symptom also.
So short of breath is the main thing that people should be watching for.
Yeah, that's very true. Look for that. And if it comes out of the blue, if you're exercising, that's one thing. But if it's just sitting in a chair, you got to be aware of that.
All right, Dr. Kopetsky, you're the best. Thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Yep, you bet. See you later. Oh, by the way, our next caller, if you want to call 507-282-1234, we have a complimentary copy of the Mayo Clinic Healthy Heart for Life book, The Mayo Clinic Plan for Preventing and Conquering Heart Disease. 507-282-1234, and it's yours.
Yep, call in, and Audrey will take that information down, our producer Audrey, and we'll get that book to you. We love this book so much. And let's move along to our final expert on the day.
All right, Dr. Matthew Tollefson is a urologist to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, and he's going to talk to us about the prostate. Dr. Tollefson, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Oh, thanks so much. Happy to come on in.
I understand you just got back from China.
I did not get back from China. I came back from Hawaii.
That's even better.
It seems like around the world, but yeah. It seems like another world entirely, actually. But
I don't feel sorry for you at all, actually.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about prostate cancer is that it used to be, they've got prostate cancer, we've got to have surgery, we've got it taken care of, and now we're kind of doing a more watchful waiting on that. That's surprising to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, prostate cancer it's the most common cancer, the most common solid cancer in American men. So it's a very, very common tumor. And the reality is that most people with prostate cancer die of other things. More men die of heart disease that have prostate cancer than actually die of prostate cancer. Having said that, prostate cancer still kills, can kill a lot of men. So it's important, and I think that the community, the medical community, has kind of come around to the fact that there are cancers we can watch and there are cancers we need to treat aggressively. And it's trying to sort that question out that's really important in prostate cancer right now.
So myth or matter of fact, prostate cancer is common, but few men actually die from it.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, 1 in 6 American men in the United States today one in six American men actually have prostate cancer, but it's much smaller than that. Only 1 in 30 or so actually die from prostate cancer.
But in fact, it is the second leading cause of cancer deaths among men in the U.S., correct?
It is. And so there are cancers that need to be treated. I don't think the message is necessarily that we can watch all of these prostate tumors, but certainly the majority of them likely could just be watched and followed, and if they show signs of getting worse, basically treating it at that point.
So how about an update on the types of surgery available? We've got the robot out there now, and a lot of people are using that. Is it really any better than conventional surgery to remove the prostate? And if it is better, why?
So that's a fantastic question. It's probably one that I get asked almost every day. I would say that, you know, if we look at prostate cancer surgery, I don't think there's been much that's revolutionized prostate cancer surgery more than the robot. 10 years ago, almost nobody was doing anything robotically. Hmm. And now in the United States, close to 80% of prostate surgeries are done robotically.
No kidding.
So it's something that has just completely revolutionized the disease. But I would argue that robot versus not robot might even be the wrong question to ask. I think plenty of studies show that it's probably not whether the robot is used, but the experience of the surgeon. So there are, many people that I see that have fantastic results with open surgery, and similarly, some people that may not have great results with robotic surgery. So many studies show that it's probably the surgeon doing it, and the number of surgeries that surgeon does and his level of expertise that lead to those outcomes, whether they be good or bad.
So tell our listeners how they know, how they can figure out who's got it and who doesn't when it comes to doing the surgery.
Exactly. So that's a great question. So studies show that surgeons that do enough of this surgery, and by enough, I would say a surgeon should be doing about 50 a year. So you can ask your surgeon or ask your urologist, how many of these do you do? And if you do, what's your comfort level? And do you prefer to do them open or robotic? And I think if you're not getting the answers that you like, it's important to get a second opinion. Prostate cancer, even the aggressive types of prostate cancers, are not immediately life-threatening. So it's something where you can take a few weeks. There's, options between surgery and radiation. Really take some time to mull over what the right decision is for you personally. And once you make that decision, if you need a second opinion, I think that's a reasonable option as well. And once you make that decision, really just try to play it out and not look back.
And just one comment, Tracy, never be afraid as a patient to ask for a second opinion. And if your surgeon or your doctor is offended, I'd go to a different doctor. I always encourage people, if they even whisper or suggest that they might want a second opinion, I always encourage that, and every physician should.
Absolutely. I think, and especially for a disease like prostate cancer, where literally we have months to make a decision, I encourage everyone after a diagnosis to get a second opinion on what else they can do.
And is the importance, whether you do a robot surgery or a conventional surgery or watchful waiting or any of that, because there could be some harm that results from this surgery? I mean, the side effects of this surgery can sometimes be worse than just watchful waiting. Is that right?
so that's exactly right, and that's the that's why the concept of watchful waiting or active surveillance has started to emerge. So the main issues that can arise after prostate cancer surgery in particular would be the potential for incontinence. So leaking urine is more common after surgery, and erectile dysfunction can certainly happen after this surgery as well. And then, you know, there's also just risks with anesthesia and risks of, you know, going off to sleep and having a major surgery. So sure. There are definitely risks and potential side effects that, you know, could be potentially avoided with just watching these types of tumors, especially the lower grade types of tumors.
Let's go back to discovering this. Let's start back at the beginning again. So when should a man first get his PSA levels checked?
Or should he ever?
I think that's another great question as well. So PSA screening is using basically a blood test to try to detect the level of a protein that's made in the prostate. And when that level goes higher, that's just a suggestion that something's not quite right with the prostate. So one of those things can be prostate cancer. And in the early 90s, PSA screening really came out as every man should have it. Mm-hmm. Storm and Norman Schwarzkopf came on Time magazine on the front cover and said every man should have a PSA test. It's now come to light that a lot of people probably were getting PSA screening that didn't need it. Hmm. A few studies showed that we screened more men in their 80s than men in their 50s, and that probably isn't the right group of people that you'd want to target for a screening test like this. But I think it's important to talk to your doctor about it because there's so many factors that go into play with deciding whether or not to get a PSA, and if you do, what to do with it. Things like age and family history certainly relate to prostate cancer risk. Most guidelines recommend talking to your doctor around the age of 50.
All right.
So once you hit 50, ask your doctor if about the advantages and disadvantages of screening with the PSA.
And if you're not yet 50, but what would be one of the first symptoms you might experience?
So one reason to screen with PSA is to try to catch this before their symptoms. Because typically once prostate cancer develops symptoms, it tends to be more aggressive and harder to treat. But things to look out for when, you know, we're thinking of prostate cancer would be blood in the urine, weight loss, and abnormal pains that just don't seem quite right. Those are all kind of common symptoms with prostate cancer.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Tollefson.
Hey, one last question. Is it fair to say, in the end, with regard to the robot versus conventional surgery, the robot takes longer, the hospitalization is shorter, but the long-term results are about the same?
I would say that's very true. That's a nice summarization.
All right. Dr. Tollefson, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
So that's a wrap on Men's Health.
That's all it took.
Perfect hour. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. You know, March is Save Your Vision Month, and you know, I'm not sure that these new glasses have saved my vision or not. They're not easy to get used to if you've never worn them. Well, and next week, the eyes have it. We'll talk with two eye specialists, Dr. Sophie Bakri and Dr. Michael Marr. There are, of course, lots of things that can happen to your eyesight, but there are lots of things that you can do to protect it. And one of the things we'll talk about, macular degeneration. You know, it's the leading cause of blindness among senior citizens in America. Difficult problem.
And this all started off because January was Glaucoma Awareness Month, and we couldn't get Dr. Bakri in here. And then I said, well, we'll just move it all. We'll put it all together. AMD and glaucoma and workplace safety. It's also Workplace Eye Safety Month. There's no shortage of celebrations and observances, that's
exactly
for sure.
And it's just disappointing that these doctors aren't immediately available when we need them.
Yeah,
so we missed her in January, but we've got
schedule.
Her next week.
That's right.
You know, we'll also talk about cataracts and glaucoma, and as you mentioned, how to protect your eyes and save your vision, including workplace eye safety. How to save your eyesight this week. Next week, sorry, on Mayo Clinic Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can access a podcast of today's program, or go to iHeartRadio for all of the shows. You can also visit us at mayoclinic.org, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers share their expertise to manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our technical director, Andy Brownell. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McCrae.
Thanks for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.